Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Christopher Rose. Ahmed ibn Tulun governed Egypt on behalf of the Abbasid dynasty for 16 years, between the years 868 to 884 of the Christian era. An aggressive and innovative actor, he pursued an ambitious political agenda, including the introduction of dynastic rule over Egypt that put him at odds with his imperial masters. Throughout his rule, however, he maintained close ties to the Abbasid house, and at no point did he assert outright independence, or so argues our guest today, Matthew Gordon. Matthew Gordon is Philip R. Shriver Professor of History at Miami University in Ohio, where he teaches Middle East and Islamic history. His previous books include The Breaking of a Thousand Swords, A History of the Turkish Military of Samarra, and a series of textbooks including The Rise of Islam and Understanding Islam. He co-edited the translation of the works of Al-Ya'qubi, which appeared in 2018 from Brill, and he is a co-editor with Antoine Barou of the University of Maryland and Allison Vacca, the University of Tennessee, of the online journal Al-Usur Al-Wusta. He is also a past president of Middle East Medievalists. I interviewed him about his new biography of Ahmed ibn Tulun, which is out in 2021 from One World Academic Press. Matthew Gordon, welcome to the New Books Network. It's our tradition here to ask our guests to tell us a little bit about themselves, their academic history, and what led them toward the project we're discussing. So how did you get interested in the first place?
This is always a tricky question because it's a question of where does one begin. I grew up in the Middle East in Beirut, so perhaps it was already in my mind to study the Middle East in some fashion or another. I then had opportunity to spend 2 years living in Marrakesh, Morocco, during which time I really became aware of the very complex texture of lived Islam. And it was at that point that I thought, okay, let's apply to graduate school and see how things turn out. I was accepted to the program at Columbia and entered the program, ended up working with Richard Bullitt, so a preeminent historian, of course, and very well known for his work. And I started out studying Moroccan history, but with always an eye to the urban landscape of the Middle East, and just perhaps because I was raised in cities, but I'm deeply interested in how cities operate and how urban populations interact with one another. For reasons I'm not quite sure of, I ended up going back in time and ended up thinking about the Abbasid Caliphate in some detail. And working with Dr. Bullitt, thought that I would first do a dissertation on the religious establishment of Baghdad. So this would have been work on the ulama of the Abbasid period, but from a social point of view, not really thinking about them as jurists per se or looking at hadith and so on, but thinking much more about them as a social collective and how what were the dynamics. A lot of work, even by that point, so we're in the mid-80s, early 90s, even by that point, a lot of work had been done on Baghdad. But what was clear, or what came clear to me, was that little work had been done on the city of Samarra, which of course replaced Baghdad as the imperial capital for about a 60-year period in the 9th century. So I thought, okay, let's take a closer look at the city of Samarra. What came clear to me very quickly is that the dominant sort of socio-political class of Samarra was made up of the Turkish military, Turkish and Central Asian military. So that sparked my interest. I began to read about that military. And at that point, largely due to the scholarship of David Ayalon, Patricia Crona, and Daniel Pipes, there was a body of scholarship around the phenomenon of the slave military, the Abbasid slave military. What I found puzzling, though, as I read those three books and read further on, and then really began to delve into the Arabic sources, primarily Tabari, but others as well, is that no real effort had been made to bring together a kind of history of the Turkish military of Samarra. So that's what took me to my first book, The Breaking of a Thousand Swords, which came out in 2001. What came clear to me is that some of the best information regarding that Turkish military had to do with Ahmed ibn Tulun and had to do with the Tulunid family in Egypt. So on completing the book, I thought, well, you know, what direction do I want to head off into now? And I thought that work on the Tulunids would be the way to go. So I've been working on Ahmed ibn Tulun now for well over a decade. And the book that we're talking about, the One World Press book, really is the fruit of sort of on-again, off-again scholarship and work over about a decade. So this is the result of you know, a number of years of effort and interest. And it's also, I should say, and sort of I guess I'm anticipating a question of that will come later. I'm anticipating working further on the Tulunids now that this book is finished. So that's a rough picture of that trajectory.
Thank you for that. You mentioned Patricia Crona, who was one of the founding editors of the series Makers, yes, of the Muslim World, in which your book appears. I know that there was some question about whether the series would continue after her unexpected passing, and it's really great to see that it's been revived with a new editorial team. Ibn Tulun is a fascinating person. I'm an Egyptian historian myself, and I really wanted to study the medieval era, but it turns out that I really don't like reading medieval Arabic poetry, which comprises a lot of the source material. But you're really speaking my language when you discuss your fascination with urban history, because the history of Cairo is one of my particular interests, and the mosque that Ibn Tulun built is one of my favorite Islamic monuments in the city. This is one of the reasons why I wanted to read this book and to talk to you about it. Can we talk about what it takes to write the biography of a historical figure from this point in history? How do you begin to construct a reasonable profile when the sources may not give you what it is that you necessarily want?
Okay, so your question is, how does one write a biography of a medieval subject? I think the very first problem, of course, are all the lacunae in our information, simply the large gaps in the information that we have on hand. And we can talk more about some of the specific examples as we move along here. But the other issue, of course, is that in a sense, we have the opposite problem for Ahmed ibn Tulun, which is that we've actually got quite a good body of information, particularly regarding his tenure in office. In other words, that 16-year period where he is serving as governor of Abbasid Egypt. And what I'm referring to primarily here are two early biographies, one by Ibn Adaya, who was a government official like his father. They both worked for the Tulunid administration. And then a somewhat later biography, the Sirat Ahmed ibn Tulun by al-Balawi, who we believe was a 12-er scholar who decided probably through an act of patronage, someone asked him to write this biography, that he penned a roughly 300 to 325 page biography of Ahmed ibn Tulun. So right there, we have a great deal of information. The great problem there, however, is, of course, that al-Balawi was not writing his biography in the way that a modern historian might write a biography, in trying to strike a certain balance and trying to ask a lot of critical questions and so on. Really, what we have is, to my mind anyway, is a work that falls pretty solidly into the Mirror for Princes literature. Mm-hmm. In other words, that he's trying to represent Ahmed ibn Tulun in a particular fashion. And what I think is going on in this very long biography is an effort to represent Ahmed ibn Tulun as almost a model amir, a model governor. Yes, he brings out his warts. Yes, he brings out what one might think of as character flaws, particularly, I think, a penchant for violence, violence against his political opponents. But otherwise, I think that he's really shaping this work to represent Ahmed ibn Tulun for later generations, and to say, okay, well, here we have this amir, this governor, and I'm going to show you why he's a kind of model for the position of governor. So that immediately skews the information. And so back to our question then is, first of all, is we've got to face all the lacunae, all those sort of gaps in our information. And then, perhaps ironically, on the other hand, is that we've also got to grapple with a lot of information that is presented to us, but with a very particular, from a very particular perspective, well, or with a particular bias at work.
One of the things that really struck me about the way you describe Ibn Tulun is as a product of Abbasid history. When I read it, it seemed so obvious, but I don't think I've ever seen him treated this way in the Egyptian historiography, where he's usually treated as an isolated figure, or he'll appear in broader studies of Arab-Islamic history as someone who took advantage of this period of fragmentation and disintegration in the Abbasid Empire. You, however, place him within the context of this particular moment in Abbasid history, which changes the narrative quite a bit. Can you describe for our listeners how this gives us additional insight into who he was and what he was trying to accomplish as governor of Egypt?
Okay, sure. Again, one relies on modern scholarship to help frame questions, both whether they are helpful questions that you want to follow or questions that seem not quite right. And we do have an extended study of the Tulunids, which focuses very much on Ahmed ibn Tulun, and that is Zaki Hassan's 1933 study, Les Tulunides. Now, it's a work in French. And it's very thorough. Now, what is interesting is that he did not have al-Balawi in hand, but nevertheless did his homework and really pursued his study. But what I found, and I find in other scholarship, as I was sort of assembling my material and gathering up what information I could find, is what was often missing was the Samarran context. In other words, to connect Ahmed ibn Tulun much more clearly to the wider politics, the wider dynamics, the wider situation of the Abbasid Caliphate at a very critical point. And as you point out, it was critical because this was the point at which the Caliphate really was coming apart at the seams, losing control over important provinces, but also facing very serious challenges within the very heartland, that is, within the very center of the empire. And there are really two developments that we want to point to. One is the rise of the Turkish and Central Asian military command, So this is a military elite that, for a number of reasons, rises to the fore within Samarra itself and begins to exert a great deal of pressure and influence over the Abbasid court, to the point that the Turkish military command sees to the nomination and then the removal of a series of caliphs, beginning with al-Mutawakkil and then five of his successors. So it's a very difficult and very violent and very disruptive time for the Abbasid court itself. The second major development then was the explosion of what most historians refer to as the Zand Revolt in southern Iraq. Together, these two events, and I should perhaps follow just to say that the Zand Revolt was a extended revolt, extending over a number of years, in which the Abbasids really lose control over the delta of the Tigris and Euphrates. They lose control over Basra, a major commercial center, and its hinterlands. And they suffer a number of military humiliations at the hands of the Zand rebels. So together, the crisis within Samarra itself, joined to the crisis of southern Iraq, meant that the Abbasids and its power circles were not able to dictate politics and dictate the course of events in major provinces. And for purposes of this conversation, of course, is that we're most interested in Egypt and what is happening in Egypt. And so the way I frame this is that we might think of Ahmed ibn Tulun as a very ambitious actor who is taking advantage of opportunity. And it's an opportunity presented within an imperial context of an empire that is falling apart, not able to control developments in the provinces. And so across the board, we see a number of different actors who are seizing the day, who are taking advantage of opportunities presented to them by what was in effect a political vacuum. And I would describe Ahmed ibn Tulun in those terms, that here is a very ambitious individual who takes office at a point where the empire cannot really dictate to him how he should conduct himself in office, and he proceeds from there.
So the first chapter of the book discusses his first decade in office. He arrives in Egypt in 868 of the Christian calendar, and you discuss what relatively little we know about his family and his education and his background. But there are two questions that you sort of highlight, one of which involves his parents' origins as enslaved or unfree persons, and another involves, as you mentioned several times, the family's Turkish origins. And as a point of curiosity, I've always been curious what it meant that somebody spoke Turkish in the 9th century. What language would that be? And I ask this question because several years ago, when I was working at a major university, we got a copy of an encyclopedia of Turkish civilization that had been put out by a press in the Republic of Turkey, who identified him as Ahmet Tulunoglu, which is what he would be in modern Turkish. And of course, my immediate question was, would he have recognized that name if someone called him that on the street? And, you know, what did it mean that somebody was a Turkish speaker in the 9th century?
Yeah, no, these are great questions. Again, we don't know nearly as much as we'd like, certainly as much as I would like, about Ahmed ibn Tulun's family, his father as well as his mother. What we do know is that Tulun was gifted by a Abbasid governor, belonged to the Samanid family, gifted to al-Ma'mun, who was the Abbasid caliph at the turn of the 9th century, and a very interesting and often, for many historians, a very controversial caliph. And so the indications are that Tulun was one of a number of young Turkish males, or I might say Turkic males, who is either purchased or captured or gifted to the Abbasid house and enrolled or recruited into a new style military formation that historians commonly refer to as the Abbasid slave military. So that Tulun was of enslaved background seems clear, at least if we accept these very brief indications. His mother is named Qasim. Now, Qasim is a, and I've had students who come up to me after I lecture on the Tulunid family, very worried, and those students who know Arabic, very worried that I'd gotten something wrong, because Qasim, of course, is a, in the modern Arabic world, is a male name. You would never name a daughter Qasim. But that is what the sources tell us was her name. It probably just followed a pattern whereby slaves were given names for various reasons, and that young female slaves were probably given male names as a kind of play, as a way to just be playful in the naming. But she is referred to as a concubine and as belonging to Tulun. She bears him four children, Ahmed and then his brother Musa, and then two sisters, about whom we know almost nothing. We have names of both women, but we know nothing else about them. So Qasim, it would appear, would have been a concubine, would have also then been enslaved. Now, what did this mean for the family? Well, there's a lot that we can't say about that topic. One question that I do bring up in the book is, what was Tulun's standing, his legal standing, at the time that he becomes a father? And what I point out is that according to Islamic law, or at least a prominent a line of opinion in Islamic law, is that slaves were not to own property. So that suggests that it would have been ruled out that he could own a concubine as a slave. So it suggests that Tulun had became a freedman. In other words, he was manumitted at some point in his career. But we don't know much more about him, and we know very little else about Qasim. But I think there is the abiding question that she is actually not identified as being Turkic. Mm-hmm. And we know that slave women, enslaved women, were brought in from a number of regions outside the boundaries of the Arab Islamic Empire. We have women brought in from the Byzantine territories. We have them brought in from Turkic territories, from Armenia, from Ethiopia, from North Africa. So the question then is, what was Qasim's background? And therefore, what kind of cultural knowledge did she bring? What kind of cultural baggage did she bring to her motherhood? And so what songs did she, you know, in what language did she sing to her children, and so on? So, you know, there are these questions that surround the parents, and therefore I think surround Ahmed ibn Tulun's childhood. But again, this is a case of where we just don't have sufficient amount of information to go a whole lot further. Now, on the question of the father, in any case, as being a Turk, and then Ahmed ibn Tulun himself is identified as a Turk in the Arabic sources, and at several points in the biography of Balawi, is said to have actually spoken Turkish with his fellow officers. So to your question, what Turkish would he have spoken? I don't know, to be frank with you. And it's actually a very good question and one that I need to pursue. But what I am also interested in is the reception in Middle Eastern urban society to the arrival of these young Turks. Mm-hmm. Because there is a lot of, there are many indications in Arabic sources as well as non-Arabic sources that the Turks were received and were viewed within Middle Eastern urban society very much as an other. Mm-hmm. In other words, to use a very outdated term at this point, I think, as a kind of barbarian, mm-hmm. perhaps how Roman society might have viewed those speaking Germanic languages, or as Chinese urban dwellers might have viewed peoples from the steppe. And so the reception to the Turks within Baghdad and Samarra and Damascus and other Middle Eastern cities, I think, would have been shot through with a real ambivalence. On the one hand, one welcomed their service, one welcomed the way in which they carried out their duties within the military and so on, that they were willing to serve the empire. But on the other hand, was a long-standing history of viewing them as effectively as a lesser people, mm-hmm. And as bringing in patterns of behavior and language and so on that were perhaps seen as not appropriate to a Middle Eastern urban environment. So this is a set of questions that I'm also thinking about as I continue to study and try to situate Ahmed ibn Tulun and then the Tulunid household in as rich a context as I can.
One of the ways that the Turkish military seems to have been able to integrate themselves was through religious means. As you point out in the book, you know, Ibn Tulun's biographers make a lot of his commitment to the faith, to Islam, and how that informed his conduct as a ruler. So why is this something that they wanted to emphasize, and what can we make of that?
Yeah, I mean, if we turn again to al-Balawi, again, we have in the Sirat Ahmed ibn Tulun, we have a very rich text with a lot of information in it, obviously about Ahmed ibn Tulun's career, but a lot of references to the kind of socio-religious context in which he's operating. And al-Balawi insists over and over again on not simply that Ahmed ibn Tulun was well-educated as a Muslim and spent time both in Samarra, but particularly on the Byzantine frontier, being educated in Islam. So he insists on that Ahmed ibn Tulun was a devout Muslim with a solid Muslim education. But also he insists on the centrality of faith, of piety, of what we might call just-mindedness to Ahmed ibn Tulun's career and to his approach to office. In other words, that faith and piety and religiosity, that these were drivers to Ahmed ibn Tulun's approach to office. Now, why is that? Again, I think that we've got to see the Sirah, that is the biography of al-Balawi, and to some extent also the biography of Ibn Adaya, this earlier work, as being composed along the lines of A Mirror for Princes. And in other words, that there is an attempt here to use Ahmed ibn Tulun to kind of model and comment on and think about the conduct of those holding political office. And so central to that, and I don't think it's any great surprise, given that these works are being produced by Muslim scholars, mm-hmm. central to that representation of Ahmed ibn Tulun then is religion, and is this turn to religion, and the need then for those who occupy political office in the Arab Islamic Empire to be guided by a commitment to, again, faith, to piety, to ideas of justice and generosity, and so on. So I this is not to deny that Ahmed ibn Tulun was a devout Muslim. The mosque is there. It stands as a monument to someone who is keenly aware of the central importance of religion to medieval Islamic life. And I think that it would be too skeptical to say that Ahmed ibn Tulun is simply represented as a good Muslim. My sense is that the man probably was very serious about his religion and very serious about his commitments to faith and piety. But again, we can't ignore that some of what we're grappling with here, or maybe a large question that we're grappling with, is this representation of Ahmed ibn Tulun And therefore, I think religion is inevitably going to be part of that description.
The first half of the book, and the books in this particular series are relatively short. So the first two chapters concern his tenure in office. He was the Abbasid governor for 16 years, from 868 to his death in 884. And one of the statements you made really kind of encapsulated his tenure, and that is, and I quote, he, meaning Ibn Tulun, arrived in Al-Fustat, the Arab Islamic center of Egypt, located at the southern end of the Nile Delta, precisely at the moment of the worst violence in Samarra, and on the eve of the Zanj Rebellion. Each of the two developments would shape his tenure in complex fashion. So can we talk more about how what was going on back in the Abbasid heartland affected the way he ruled Egypt?
I think it's absolutely critical to place him in that context. In other words, to join his career and the pursuit of a very ambitious political agenda, to join it to a rather precipitous decline or precipitous fall in Abbasid imperial authority. On the one hand, so this is what I'm referring to then, is the violence at the heart of the Abbasid state in Samarra. And then I would also join it to the Zanj Rebellion, and that those two together really, in a sense, distracted the empire and allowed for ambitious actors across the empire then to act on their ambitions. So I think this is a good way to think about Ahmed ibn Tulun. So what he sets out with then is a very ambitious agenda. Now, one question that I do bring up in the book is, at what point does he recognize that he has an opportunity at hand? And I'm not sure we can really pin this down. I mean, we obviously can't hear from him, and the biographies don't really speak to that question directly. In other words, that we don't get any direct statements that, you know, from this point forward, Ahmed ibn Tulun now pursued his agenda. But I think a critical turn was when he took control of the fiscal administration in Egypt, which, you know, we could date to about 3 or 4 years into his administration. And this involved confronting the very well-positioned and equally ambitious fiscal official, Ibn al-Mudabbir by name, who had served al-Mutawakkil very well as a fiscal official, had been appointed to Syria and Jordan, and then following some controversy in his career, ends up in Egypt. And what we understand from references in the Arabic sources, as well as some very negative references in the Coptic sources, is that Ibn al-Mudabbir pursued a rather harsh fiscal plan. In other words, imposing new taxes and seeing to the sort of very thorough and exacting imposition of the existing tax administration, and became deeply unpopular as a result. But he was, of course, he represented the empire, probably was well protected. So we've got a fiscal program in place when Ahmed ibn Tulun arrives in Egypt. And within 2 or 3 years, as I say, he's able to effect control over those fiscal offices, which involves a confrontation with Ibn al-Mudabbir and probably his top representatives in the fiscal administration. And it's interesting to see how both Ibn Adaya and al-Balawi really almost seem to enjoy telling the story of this confrontation between the two men. The outcome, in any case, is that Ahmed ibn Tulun takes over the fiscal administration at a point at which not only is a heightened level of revenue flowing into the treasuries of al-Fustat, but that the necessary steps had been taken by Ibn Tulun's predecessors, and then we also see Ahmed Ibn Tulun doing the same, of clamping down on any remaining opposition within the rural districts of Egypt. And I think this is an important point that we also want to bring out, is to connect what I have referred to in a forthcoming article as a campaign of pacification that is carried out by Ahmed Ibn Tulun's predecessors, that is the governors before him, also I think by Ibn al-Mudabbir, and then by Ahmed Ibn Tulun himself once he takes over, to crack down on what remains of fiscal and political opposition, which means then that as a result of Ibn al-Mudabbir's fiscal program, joined to this kind of political crackdown, that there was a heightened revenue flow into al-Fustat. And so Ahmed Ibn Tulun, I think, sets his sights on taking over the fiscal administration of Egypt, recognizing that there were very serious resources in play, and that if he could lay control of those fiscal resources, he could then pursue what apparently was an emerging political agenda. And that's exactly what he does from that point forward. And we do read about, in Balawi in particular, but other sources as well, of the very considerable wealth of the Tulunid treasuries and the very considerable wealth that Ahmed ibn Tulun leaves to his successor, Khumarawe, his son, at the close of his 16-year tenure. So we've got, in other words, a context of crisis within the empire that allows local political actors to seize the day. And in the case of Ahmed ibn Tulun, seizing the day meant, I believe, seizing control of the fiscal administration of Egypt and then moving forward from that point.
You cover a bit of the fiscal administration and the conflict with al-Mudabbir in the third chapter. Yeah. You also talk about the fact that when he arrived in Egypt, things weren't going well in the provinces. There was a lot of discontent with the previous governor of Egypt. And one of the things that, as you've already mentioned, is that he had to restore order throughout the country in order to get the revenue flowing again. How was he able to accomplish that?
This is where I think it's really important to try to place Ahmed ibn Tulun in a broader context. What I find is that often he's treated as somehow representing a break from the policies and the conduct of those men who came before him. And I don't think that that's really the way one wants to go. I think it's more helpful to think about Ahmed ibn Tulun as representing an effort on the part of the Abbasid Empire, but very specifically, and this is an argument that I suggest in the book, but that I'm trying to develop in another forthcoming article, which is to recognize that Egypt probably was a very specific interest for the Samarran military command. We know that a number of those men had properties in Egypt. These would have been land holdings, effectively, from which they grew wealthy, but that they were also specifically interested in bringing about a political order to Egypt in order to enhance the flow of fiscal resources. Also, I think, to tap into the labor market of Egypt. Mm-hmm. But what does this mean? This means that efforts were already afoot under Ibn Tulun's predecessors in order to bring about peace and order to Egypt. So when Ahmed ibn Tulun arrives, his predecessor, Yazid ibn Abdullah, and then the military command in Egypt itself, had already engaged in a number of confrontations with tax rebels and other sources of opposition in Egypt. When Ahmed ibn Tulun arrives then, is that in effect he completes that effort. In other words, he cracks down on what I take to be the last of the sources of opposition in Egypt. And so what I'm saying, in other words, is that we want to think about Ahmed ibn Tulun as a bringing an effort to culmination, an effort at bringing about law and order in Egypt in order to enhance both the flow of fiscal wealth, but also to enhance that stability, to take advantage of that stability in the empire, I'm sorry, in the province.
Speaking of law and order, or I suppose this makes a nice segue into talking about the House of Tulun itself. There were a number of struggles within the family. You discuss what was going on with his brother Musa, as well as the issues that occurred when he passed away in 884, and his son Humarawey then proceeds to succeed him. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, this I'm really quite fascinated with, and hope to really pursue this further, to think about medieval households and to think about what does it mean to run a large and very unwieldy household, which is by all indications exactly what Ahmed ibn Tulun dealt with all the way through his career. And there are three individuals that are of interest in this regard. There is his brother Musa, who apparently was a real headache for Ahmed ibn Tulun. Musa, from an very early point, insisted in public and presumably in private to his brother that he share in the power and also the resources of Egypt, and that his brother Ahmed pushed back on that. And that led to a real severing of relations with between the two brothers. We then later, within 5-6 years, if I'm getting my dating right, we have a revolt, a very clumsy and rather strange revolt on the part of his eldest son, Al-Abbas, who up to that point, I think Ahmed ibn Tulun had thought of as being his successor. So Al-Abbas, at a point at which where Ahmed ibn Tulun is on campaign in Syria, Al-Abbas is encouraged by a circle of followers, both military men, but also a kind of group of, they're described as poets and as close companions of Al-Abbas. So these would have been civilians. So a circle of advisors who encourage him then to plunder the wealth of his father's treasury and then to march out of Egypt into North Africa. So it's a strange event. To call it a rebellion is perhaps erroneous, but it is what we do term it. Ahmed ibn Tulun learns of this so-called rebellion, hurries back to Egypt, but in the meantime, Al-Abbas has behaved so badly in North Africa in trying to kind of impose his own authority in Ifriqiya that he is badly defeated by an army of the Aghlabids, aided by some other forces in North Africa. And so that when the Tulunid forces march out against Al-Abbas, they find that he is, in fact, in full retreat. And a small vanguard force then brings Al-Abbas back to Egypt, where he is forced by his father to undergo a kind of public humiliation. What's interesting is that Ahmed ibn Tulun keeps his son around. And it's only Humarawey that ends up probably seen to the murder of his brother, which we can take to be, internecine family politics at work. I mean, there's something almost Shakespearean about this confrontation between the two brothers. And then finally, I think the event that really was a profound crisis for the Tulunid household and brings up all kinds of interesting questions about blood ties versus clientage ties within these complex households, and that is the betrayal of Lulu. Lulu, or Pearl in Arabic, was probably a client and a freedman of the Tulunid household. He may have been a eunuch because he is referred to as a khadim, but this is a somewhat controversial term. But nevertheless, this is a very important client of Ahmed ibn Tulun's and of the Tulunid household, who rises up the ranks of the Tulunid military, and at a particular point is assigned a very important political and military assignment in Syria. Effectively, I think he is appointed by Ahmed ibn Tulun to govern the territories that Ahmed ibn Tulun assumed authority over in Syria. And so he gives him the number one spot as his governor in Syria. At this point, Lulu betrays Ahmed ibn Tulun. He takes his military forces and he offers them up to al-Muwaffaq, who is the Abbasid regent. And more interestingly, he is also the individual who is in charge of the Abbasid response to the Zanj revolt. And so all of these events are kind of coming together. So what Lulu does then is offers up the Tulunid forces under his authority to al-Muwaffaq, and al-Muwaffaq immediately puts those Tulunid forces to work against the Zanj, and according to At-Tabari, that they played a very key role in finally squashing the Zanj revolt. And it is a member of Lulu's army that in fact brings the head of the severed head of the Zanj leader back to Samarra and offers it to al-Muwaffaq, which effectively brings an end then to the Zanj revolt. But back to the point is that with Musa, with al-Abbas, and then with Lulu, we have indications both of the size but also of the real complexity of this one medieval household, and allows us then to think about the dynamics of this one particular socio-political formation within the medieval Islamic world.
Your final chapter, City and Ceremony, looks at some of the symbols of power and the actions that Ibn Tulun used to legitimize his rule. He built an entirely new capital city adjacent to Fustat, and of course the mosque that still exists. Anybody who's visited recognizes the labor and the expense that went into it. How did he do this, and why was this so important, considering, as you've argued, that he did not declare autonomy or independence from the Abbasid state? And I again have to stress that this is not usually the story that one gets in the Egyptian historiography, where I've seen him almost presented as sort of a 9th century counterpart to Mehmet Ali of the 19th century, you know, sort of moving in the direction of independence. So this is a really interesting take and something I found very fascinating.
Yeah, no, it is indeed. And yes, I too have run into statements regarding Ahmed ibn Tulun as an independent Egyptian ruler. And I have raised questions of that characterization. And again, I would bring Ahmed ibn Tulun back into the context of Samarra. In other words, to think seriously about his background in Samarran military circles, because after all, that is where he learned, where he cut his political teeth. Mm-hmm. And where he acquired presumably the background, the knowledge, the sense of how one conducted oneself in elite politics. In other words, the way I like to describe it is that Ahmed ibn Tulun was playing by Samarran rules when he takes office in Egypt. And I think central to that effort was to strike a kind of balance. On the one hand, you want to draw as much of the symbolic, religious, and political capital of the Abbasid Caliphate, to draw on it and to attach it to one's office as much as possible. But on the other hand, is to also exploit Egypt's fiscal and human and military resources as much as possible. So the way I describe it in the book and in you know, when I speak of Ahmed ibn Tulun in public talks, is that he struck a kind of balance. And I think so did so effectively. That on the one hand is that he played up his relationship to the Abbasid Caliphate, in order to exploit its symbolic religious and political qualities. But on the other hand, recognized that he had an opportunity to really pursue an agenda of his own. And so I think his whole career is dictated by that very balancing act. Now, ultimately, I think that he never really achieved full success. In other words, he never really found the right formula. And the Abbasid center, represented particularly by Al-Muwaffaq, the Abbasid regent, was able to consistently resist Ahmed ibn Tulun, consistently raise questions of his legitimation, consistently summon up opposition to the Tulunid project. And that will remain. In other words, after Ahmed ibn Tulun is dead, the opposition, the resentments, the animosity within the Abbasid center remained. And Khumarawe, over the course of his career, and then the Tulunids who succeed Khumarawe for a short period of about 10 years before the collapse of the dynasty in 905, that those same individuals faced the same opposition and animosity. So Ahmed ibn Tulun, I believe, tried to strike this kind of balance, and it worked for him, although, again, I don't think that he was able to really achieve a sort of 100% success in that regard.
So we're just about at time, but before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now and what your next project might be?
Sure. I'm wrapping up several shorter projects, and those involve about two or three essays on the Tulunids. I think it's something that many in the audience will be familiar with, is that, you know, once you're done with a writing project, in this case, the biography of Ahmed ibn Tulun, is you start to think about, okay, what remains to be said, or what ideas do I want to develop further? So I'm going to wrap up a couple of shorter essays, but I do have two longer-term projects that I've been engaged with and want to pursue further. One is a study of al-Balawi's biography of Ibn Tulun. In other words, I want to turn to some of the historiographical questions that I bring up in the biography. Connected with this is also a translation project that I'm involved with Mathieu Tillier, who teaches in Paris, to translate the well-known work of Al-Kindi, which is a study of the governors of Egypt. So that is one project that I'm involved in, which is to delve much further into Egyptian historiography from the 9th century. Now, the other project that I've been involved in for a long time, and this also comes out of that first book, The Breaking of a Thousand Swords, is a study of slavery in the early Abbasid period. So working with colleagues, I'm pursuing that. And, you know, my hope is that that will produce a full-length or book-length study of unfreedom and enslavement in the first Abbasid period. So, you know, knock on wood, I'll see these things through to fruition.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to those. Matthew Gordon's new book, Ahmed ibn Tulun, is in the Makers of the Muslim World series published by One World Academic Press, and it's out in 2021. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. It's been really great to talk to you.